Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today, Matt and Chris are joined by Brian McGrath to discuss Brian's views on the future of American maritime strategy. We are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Tell all of your friends about us. Remember to leave a comment and a 5-star rating. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is a figment of your fevered imagination. You should rest by sitting back and enjoying the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today, I am joined by our membership secretary, Chris Barber, as well as the former destroyer CEO, Brian McGrath, who is also a sage in the maritime security field. Today, our intention is to talk about American maritime strategy in the future, what our next steps are, how our allies will fit into this equation, the platforms and the concepts that we will need to take forward with us. Brian, it's a pleasure to have you.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, usually what we do, we could read a bio, and that would be really easy, but it's more refreshing. It's a better perspective to ask the guest to introduce themselves, what they think are the important beats of their career and their perspective. So if you could give the form, if you would, an introduction to yourself in your own words.
Sure. I am I'm a graduate of the University of Virginia, which I think, along with being a naval officer, is the formative experience. They are the formative experiences of my life. And I graduated in 1987, went straight into surface warfare. In fact, I graduated on got commissioned on Saturday, graduated on Sunday, played golf with my friends on Monday, and reported to my ship on Tuesday. So I didn't get my 30 days of basket leave or whatever it is that some.
Well, I was still in a basket at the time, so.
Very good, very good. I will not quibble with your inexperience as we speak today. Spent 21 years in the Navy, a frigate, 1, 2, 3 cruisers, and commanded a destroyer at sea, primarily East Coast ships. Got into Aegis when Aegis was still pretty young and cool. I think within my time in the Navy, being part of great Aegis cruisers with wonderful captains is what sort of helped push me along. Commanded Bulkley from middle of 2004 to middle of 2006. Was drafted by OpNav to come up and lead a little team that was going to write a maritime strategy, which was it was interesting because I was at the Joint Forces Staff College Phase 2 thinking that I was going to OpNav N86, Director of Surface Warfare, what it was called then, 86. When there was a story at where the CNO, the then CNO, Admiral Mullen, talked about the need for a new maritime strategy and that we're going to undertake a new maritime strategy. And I remember saying to some friends at Phase 2 there, I said, boy, I pity this son of a bitch who gets that job. And it was about it really wasn't more than a week or so later that I got called and said that I'm the guy. So I did that. Thought it was a good step off the stage tour, and retired once that was in the can. And I've been a consultant ever since. I consult primarily on national security issues, almost exclusively Navy, although I've done a good bit of Army work in the last 2 years, and both for public and private clients.
Perfect. Well, today's show is primarily inspired by your article in National Interest and your work in 2007 on that cooperative strategy for 21st century sea power. So you reflected on that and you said the new document's coming out, it's in the works, and I think your words were, if there's still room for debate, here are some of my thoughts. And rather than having me rehash the article, perhaps you can discuss what you think are the most important foundational concepts of America's future maritime strategy and then we'll discuss where that might take us in other realms.
Yeah, I'm going to assume the listener has some background in the 2007 strategy that is still that still is the governing document. That strategy was written for a time where we were, as the French foreign minister referred to us, I believe, as a hyperpower. China had begun to kind of make some noise, but they weren't quite feeling their adolescent oats as they are today. Obviously, the war on terror was still very much in everyone's mind. We had a Secretary of Defense who was looking at the service chiefs every day and saying, "What have you done for these counterinsurgency efforts today?" There was a feeling in the Navy that this too shall pass, that we will eventually get back to doing things navies do. And so we wrote this maritime strategy, but it was rather vague. I mean, we were planning to fight one country or a group of countries. It wasn't like there was an existential threat. There were threats, and we attempted to name them and to devise what was essentially a strategic defense, strategy of the strategic defense. In this case, the defense is the global system that works to everyone's advantage.
And that was, I think, the phrase that was up front in the document was that wars, preventing wars is as important as winning them, I think.
Yes.
Would you say
yes.
Some of that statement?
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is when you take a bumper sticker like that and start to peel away at it and start to think about force structure ramifications, the Navy that you buy to deter wars is not exactly the same Navy you would buy if you only wanted to fight wars. There's a large circle of overlap, but there's stuff that's outside that. A lot of sort of everyday presence, low-end kinds of stuff. Stuff that's very important to maritime security isn't necessarily essential for fighting wars, right? So when you look at what we were trying to do was balance the portfolio a little bit more with that statement and going forward. So that's the old one. So in 2009, I started to think, well, this is ridiculous. The threat has clarified. The Chinese have made it very clear to me, at least, that that they intend to challenge our leadership in the Western Pacific. I'm kind of an old school international 101, international relations 101 kind of guy. Look at the world very realistically. John Mearsheimer likes to say that our foreign policy is that we dominate our hemisphere and we allow no other country to dominate their hemisphere the way we dominate ours.
I like that. That's a really good
It's sort of the way
sticker,
he sort of looks at the world that way, because face it, if they are capable of dominating their own hemisphere, they may start looking at ours, right? So that's his view of 60 years of international American foreign policy and international relations. I tend to buy into that, and I tend to think that it is in our best interest to see to it that China does not feel that it is exercising hemispheric dominance. It's far from that right now, obviously, right? I mean, I think you look at a 2014 force on force kind of thing, and only the most weak-kneed Cassandra would say that we were well matched or that we were in danger of losing some sort of a conflict. But the trajectories are not favorable to us. China is building. It is improving. It is qualitatively and quantitatively moving to a place where it believes it can eject us or make it too dangerous for us to operate in the Western Pacific. And this is anathema. because in order to do what we do best, and what only we do, which is to project power, whether through carrier air power, surface launched cruise missiles, or 18-year-old infantrymen coming off of amphibious ships, you must control the water in which you operate in order to do those things. And they are busily working to challenge our ability to do that. So this new strategy has to take that head on. It has to name names. It should have a harder edge. It should be more about contesting China, primarily China, but also Iran, secondarily North Korea. This anti-sea control strategy, some call it A2AD. Ultimately, though, our aim, our strategic aim, is to be able to create and maintain local sea control wherever we wish to, for however long we wish to, in order to project power from that spot. And I think that's where the strategy has to go. The strategy has to be, as I said, harder edged. It has to be sort of relentless about this concept of sea control, freedom of the seas, counter sea denial. It has to have a more of a geostrategic flair to it. I mean, if you look around, there are countries that matter, just frankly, matter more than others, right? Egypt matters. Why does Egypt matter? It has a canal. South Africa matters. Why does South Africa matter? Because if that canal gets closed, you got to go around. And if you have a friendship with South Africa, if you have a friendship with India, if you have a friendship with Saudi Arabia, you start to pick off these geostrategically important places, and you start to create geostrategically favorable conditions for your ability, to win a globalized conflict.
So this is far more, I think you said it yourself to a point, it's far more focused. So the 2007 document, it concentrated on that concept of cooperative, very global stability, international system. And what you're talking about here is very focused, almost, I don't want to say you're focusing on a tactic, because A2AD, area denial, is far more than a tactic, but it's very attacking something that is very deadly to one of our particular abilities. So it is a lot more
Two things. The 2007 strategy stressed cooperation, but if you ask the guy who wrote most of the words of it, which is me, it was cooperation in the effort to maintain our position of global leadership. Okay? It wasn't just cooperation for cooperation's sake.
Be friends, of course.
Well, there's an element of that, but it was all about attempting to promote and sustain a system that we benefited disproportionately from, the rules of which we had a disproportionate role in making. And so, you know, that strategy got a reputation of being a little bit of a softer edged, and that's okay. It certainly is. But at the end of the day, it was all about maintaining our place as the top dog.
So same strategic goal. So two
same strategic goal, except what I'm identifying here is the basic strategic threat to the security and prosperity of the United States of America is the threat to freedom of the seas. That threat is most cogently represented by what the People's Republic of China is currently doing, and they provide a very effective planning mechanism for how we might create a strategy to combat that.
Chris?
Yeah. I first of all, I want to tell Mr. McGrath I'm a huge fan of his work. I've been following him here since I've gotten involved with SimSec. I think he's done some really interesting thinking and writing on several of these issues. And I say that in the hopes of putting up a little bit of a shield before I play the proverbial rhesus monkey throwing the stuff against the arguments that have been framed. I think, sir, that I lay down, as our Venn diagrams go, with only 20 to 30% difference of view as what you've laid out for an updated national maritime strategy, when you wrote that national maritime strategy in 07, I was a first classman at Kings Point. I can remember reading it then and kind of stepping off into my Marine Corps career, having read that and looking at it. And so I think it was a you know, pretty good for what you had, as you described some of the limitations in terms of the war that the Navy had maybe not been in, as involved into up to that point as in previous engagements. Obviously, I'm going to go for the easy target here for the one Marine in the room. And you do have a point in your national interest about a single maritime force.
And it's
very service unification like, if I may characterize it that way. And I'd like to get your clarity on that position, and then from that maybe try to poke some holes into it, you know, if sure. I even have the ability to.
Sure. I look at American sea power as a unitary concept. It is a bubble of influence, diplomacy, power, you name it, that moves. Sometimes it's totally in the blue water. Sometimes it's in the littorals. Sometimes it extends ashore. But American sea power is the world's most mobile and lethal air force, the world's most deadly navy, and the world's toughest middleweight land force, all acting together as an integrated force. Right? I want to fight as a Department of the Navy. I don't want to just organize, train, and equip, sort of. As a Department of the Navy, I want to fight. I want to staff. I want to organize, train, equip, create doctrine, the whole nine yards. And so, in my view, you can dither around on, you know, liaison officers and maybe a combined staff here or there. And never ever get to my goal of an integrated fighting unit. Or you can look at the natural extension of the argument, which is a single service that acquires things, that plans to fight, that organizes, trains, equips, and creates doctrine for American sea power. Now the thing that we have to I would ask you to think about right now is I was the destroyer captain for an expeditionary strike group. There was a Marine colonel who was the MEU commander. Okay. If you look at the affinity diagram and the overlaps and the things that he was worried about that I was worried about, it wasn't that huge, but there was quite a bit. I mean, I was there to protect his Marines. I was there when they went ashore. I was there to protect his air as they went on bombing, all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, if you look at an aircraft carrier battle group and you try to make that same affinity diagram between the CO of a submarine and the CO of a fighter squadron, there's almost no overlap. So what I'm trying to tell people who are afraid that they're, and I'm not saying you're one of these, but this is one of the primary criticisms, is that the Marines and parts of the Navy are already far closer together than parts of the Navy are to itself. All right. And so,
I concur with that to a point. The one part I'd like to bring up is the Navy you described is the Navy we had before World War II, where we engaged in more amphibious operations, you know, since that point. And my worry with that is on paper, the efficiencies gained from a unified service look great. I think, you know, the historical record points to that the inefficiencies allow for flexibilities that only emerge in combat. And I bring up, you know, I'll go to the common Marine refrain of, you know, Guadalcanal, Tarawa, instances where we had a Navy designed pre-World War II to fight very Mahanian sea control battles that did not quite stack up to the task prior to incidents like that. I say that in full recognition that it's a give and take. There were areas where the Marine Corps was completely malfeasant, maybe in how it chose to go after what it did and some of the choices it made. You know, look no further than Okinawa. There are more sailors killed in Okinawa than there were Marines or soldiers. And that was even in that stage, late stage of the war, there was a lack of sea control going on in and around that battle space to allow us to truly dominate it. So I say that and down to the nitty gritty, and you spoke about this and to get your strategy is you want to really strike to the heart of the matter and not speak in superficialities or kind of buzzwords. So I look at that call for a unified Navy, and what I see is not a huge investment in amphibious shipping. I don't see a huge investment in emerging capability needs a la amphibious combat vehicle, things of that nature. I do see probably a bigger investment in Ford class carriers, LCS, Zumwalt, big Navy, sea control, Mahanian type things that, while certainly important to that spectrum of conflict you described, I can't point out to a time in the Pacific where there hasn't been a need for diversity and variety in how any conflict would shape up there. And that diversity and variety does not generally spring forth from the bastion of unification. The enemies that we have most easily picked apart have been those enemies that had unified militaries, the Republican Guard, Saddam's Republican Guard, things of that nature. So I just offer that counter, and I'd like to hear your retort to it, sir.
Well, let me start by recognizing that since you have already waved the bloody shirt of Guadalcanal, I am authorized to make other sweeping generalizations about Marines.
Yeah, and I did not intend that as a generalization. I just a second point I'd like to maybe address in this to have you address in the strategy is. And this encompasses my first point. I'm an amateur at this, like I said. I don't have the depth on the bench intellectually that you do. But I would like
stop
to
stop that. Stop that.
I'd like to say that, you know, even an amateur like myself can look at the history of naval warfare, and we can see that the a priori examples don't hold forth very well. We have a sail. We have a wooden navy with sails that quickly that transforms to a steam-based dynamic, and maybe that doesn't happen as quickly or the way it needs to. Prior to World War II, we're all talking battleships. We emerged from World War II with a carrier-based navy. And so in a service that historically has a lack of test beds in peacetime, land services or quasi-land services, amphibious land services, we have the benefit of getting a lot of little examples to test ourselves out with. The Navy, unfortunately, doesn't. They really have to plan in darkness as it comes to the next conflict. And with the history of kind of planning the wrong way, and I'm not saying that we're doing that now, but in terms of force structure, technology, defense industrial base stuff, we have more often gotten it wrong than we've gotten it right for the next war as it pertains to naval engagements. How do you then couch that at that larger criticism in how we should design the sea control Navy? Or I don't want to phrase it that way, how we should design this next Navy.
The it's in your DNA as a Marine to be paranoid, and I understand that. I really do. I mean, your self-deprecation is it's just ridiculous because you've got a great mind. You've framed several amazing questions there that I can't possibly answer in a complete and thorough way in the time we have, even if I knew what the hell I was saying, which I don't. But I don't understand why you would necessarily think that a single maritime service that maintained a Marine Corps, just like it would maintain a surface warfare corps and a submarine corps. Why a Marine Corps operating in that environment couldn't help project a new brand of sea power? you know, I've written quite a bit about the there's only one Joint Strike Fighter that I really care about, and it's the Marines version. Why? Because it gives me 11 or 12 more carriers. I realize the Marines believe that we're going to use those magnificent beasts for close air support, but we're not going to use those magnificent beasts for close air support. Those are phenomenal power projection platforms. And when you think about what they bring to this bubble of sea power that I described earlier, it's eye-watering as far as I'm concerned, because then you've really taken a step up in your ability to project power. I think about examples like I've written about, where we would have I don't know what we call it, a maritime security module on LCS, and I would have two attack helicopters, no joke marine attack helicopters. They may have to be marinized. There may have to be something that happens, but some number of Marines. And this ship does things like small unit tactics training with friends in the littorals. It is a kick-ass anti-swarm kind of platform. But at the end of the day, it is sea power, right? It is a ship with weapons that can reach out and touch somebody, including Marine infantrymen. Now, your historical analogy is a pretty good one. It is, at least from the perspective of what it would look like, it would look a lot more like the pre-World War II Department of the Navy than it would this last 50 or 60 years. But if every other chief of service was a Marine, if the Marine Corps still had a 3-star who ran its organized training and equipping, just like the Navy submarine force would have its, you may have to bump that up to a 3-star, but at the end of the day, what I'm suggesting is a unified, fair, not a lead service and a lag service, not like the amphibious guys used to say in department head school, Marines and transportation, or talking about a real service that's organized, that is created in order to project power from the sea. While that bubble is over the blue waters, I want access to those attack helicopters to go out and look for periscopes and help prosecute the ASUW picture. I want the ships. I mean, I want to be able to take a call for fire from the Marines without a friggin' Comanche board and pencils. I realize we're getting closer with Navy Fires Control System, but at the end of the day, because the Marines have spent so much time ashore in the last several years, they have created their own C3I stovepipe. When Admiral Harvey tried to do Bold Alligator 2 years ago, it was amazing how much stuff the Marines had to bring on board the flagship, and they virtually took over huge portions of real estate because the two services couldn't talk to each other again. That's unacceptable. So I mean your paranoia has historical basis to it, and I respect it. But my United States Maritime Service, or United States Sea Service, would be created in a way that made sure that there was rotating leadership, so that the Third Fleet guy would sometimes be a vice admiral and sometimes a lieutenant general. The chief of service would be a 4-star Marine and a 4-star admiral, and the deputy would be the other flavor. It's that level of integration, because what you do isn't that different than what I do?
Maybe to bring in another example too, Chris, is what happened recently in the Gulf is we had Army Apaches operating with the Ponce and some carriers, and I think the Green Bay too. Is what I thought was odd about that when I was out there is I would have always assumed if you're looking to defend a high-value asset, it would have been a Marine helicopter. So I thought it was odd that we were using these Army assets, and maybe we do a disservice to ourselves, like Brian suggests, by going like why would we even consider it? Apache is a great platform, but then you think, why use these when I have an entire service who has a long tradition of using these things in an amphibious assault? So using them to the shore along to the shore is not that much different from not going to the shore, but just staying in that immediate area of the vessel. So, I don't know, Chris.
I think that's an Army's play in an age where its relevance is, you know, service wise, it's on a down glide slope in terms of force structure to play to gain mission set. So that's all I think the Ponce example is. I concur with both you in the fact that I don't understand why we would have done that except for some experimentation via joint means. As it pertains to a single unified maritime force, I am circumspect of the service now that gets 6 cents on the defense dollar, the Marine Corps, and is the smallest, you know, maritime service outside the Coast Guard when it's incorporated into the DoD.
Shipmate, that's because the Navy's buying your airplanes. Come on, let's keep this.
I gotcha. And that's again why I think, you know, yeah. I would argue that I think the F-35 Bravo's the last thing the Marine Corps needs. I think it's killing our ability to actually do what Marine Corps Air should do, which is close support. I want you guys doing the strike missions. I want you guys taking care of the air-to-air threat. I want you guys specializing in that. I care about the plane that can give me hang time, which the 35 can't, 35 Bravo can't, that can give me a large payload, 35 Bravo can't. I care less about the whiz-bang whistles of getting through the fifth-gen air defenses because I want you guys to do that for me, probably much better than I'll be able to do it before I go into that. But don't you think
these kinds of trades would be more efficiently made within one service?
As pertains if we acquisition wise,
yeah,
I think yes, concur, and I think before the Harrier, the Marine Corps never took a plane that the Navy hadn't already built and hadn't already satisfied. So I think it's bad practice for Marines to take large end item platforms that don't move on the ground. Or potentially move from a ship to shore and design them from the ground up, because they don't have the greatest history, all but a very small sample size, the Harrier and the JSF. But those, the purely Marine design, Marine requirement driven planes, don't seem to do that well, under the guise of operational looks. Harriers are great.
I think when I look at what goes on in the world, and when I look at where people live, and when I look at where conflicts are and our interests are that really matter, 80% of them are in our wheelhouse. It is the case for the two services together in some manner, coordinated, integrated, cooperation, whatever it is, to do that better and more seems to me to be a manifest, right? Because we're there, we're out, we're around, we're doing things. Deterrence, conventional deterrence, is a function of forces there, not forces back at Fort Riley or at Anderson Air Force Base. Forces that are there. That's what conventional deterrence is all about. That's what the Navy and Marine Corps do, and I think that is primarily this. It's almost exclusively this phase 0, phase 1 stuff. And I believe that most of the stuff that comes up is within the power of American sea power, broadly understood, to handle. Supported, of course, by space provided by someone else, by tanking provided by someone else, by special operations forces, you name it. And then when the thing is bigger than we bring in the Army. When the thing is bigger than we bring in the Air Force.
I'll buy that and a bag of chips any day of the week. I just don't know how we accomplish. I don't know how we accomplish that better under your proposed single.
Because we don't buy two kinds of commands and control systems. Because we don't overlap acquisition. Why do I pay as a taxpayer for the Marine Corps Combat Development Command and the Navy Warfare Development Command? Why do I pay for those things?
For those two ones, because there's the mission sets that the Navy, largely for the last 10 years, because the Marine Corps was at war, fighting a war that it was not prepared largely to fight.
Yeah, but McSittick has existed for more than 10 years.
I got you. So to expound on that, hey, I think as it pertains to Goldwater Nichols, which needs a drastic updating, anything that allows services to talk, shoot, and move, you know, shoot, move, and communicate together better is good. I'm all about, I loved CNO Greenheart's, you know, payloads, not platforms proposal. And the reason I love that is because it makes a lot more sense to me that if you look at the history of joint, and I'm not just talking Marine Corps, Navy, joint development, the things that work the best are the payloads. Hellfire, joint program, works great. You know, LAMPS pods work great. You know, joint refueling stuff works great. Anytime we get into the joint platform business, we muck it up pretty bad. So I'm with you as it pertains to there should be no reason that on a MEW, that MEW commander and that Navy, you know, that afloat commander. I don't think the ESG is in existence anymore though, right? So I think I think they need to be able to talk. There needs to be a single communication suite. We need to be able to move from that shipborne operations center ashore and have that good battle handover. That stuff, there is no excuse at the American.
But what I'm telling you is there shouldn't be a battle handover. I mean, we have for 70 years patted ourselves on the back about the effectiveness of amphibious operations and command and control, CADF and CLIF and all that crap. And the dirty little secret of it is that it has always been personality driven. That the effectiveness of that organization depends on the two people in charge. And I don't like organizations that rely on that. I want a command and control structure that is stronger than the individuals that are in it. And so when I think of this bubble of sea power that in some case, you know, let's say it's a two-star Marine in charge. He is in charge of the seaward version and he's in charge of the land version. There isn't some change of command. There isn't some passage.
Let me jump in.
Okay. No. I just got a great point, and my thick head will lose it if I don't jump in really quick. You know, that is the best codification of a Marxist command and control system that I've heard of as it pertains to the military. I don't think you're a Marxist, Mr. McGrath, and I'm not trying to be polemic here. Just because that sounds exactly to the effect of, hey, that pipe fitter can do just as good of a job as an architect. They're both labor. They should be that labor should be interchangeable. And the point I'm getting to is that I think you have, of course it's going to be personality driven, because that Marine commander and the experiences that have shaped him, and that, you know, ESG commander, MEW commander, the experiences that have shaped them are going to be very, very different. And the tasks in front of both of them, while there is a significant amount of overlap, as you reach the divergent part, they are not interchangeable.
Chris,
and I don't think you're going to grow a Navy commander or a Marine commander that can do either or. I say this as a probably one of the oddest examples of Marines. I went to the Merchant Marine Academy. You know, I'm experienced with shipboard operations from not a Navy SWO perspective, but other ways, and these are drastically different perspectives that you're dealing with. I don't know if you can grow that same individual.
And so, like every other military staff, you have those people at your disposal who are well-versed in it. You would have – there would be a ground element commander. There's no question about that. Just like there's an anti-air warfare commander, just like there is an anti-surface and anti-submarine warfare commander. But they would all report to the single head. And you, if you would like to call that Marxist, I like to call it unity of command, which happens to be one of our most time-honored principles.
I was speaking more to the interchangeable of labor rather than the unity command piece. I'm down with it. And I don't want to get too caught up on the – I don't want to be the single Marine drowning out the rest of the voices here. So Matt, I
– No, that's all right. I was actually going to speak to one of your points, and I think, Brian, what I think shows Chris's perspective best on this is maybe you, sir, are concerned more with possibly that unity of command concept. I know Chris – based on your writings before, particularly Avoid Change for Its Own Sake, Ground Force Unification on SimSec, is I think what your worry is you look particularly at that developmental diversity where you say, hey, if I have a unified concept, if I have a bunch of people with the same experiences, you actually value that difference, I think, where you say, I've got a guy who's done all surface, and I've got a guy who's done all marine stuff, and they have their own perspectives, and that mix creates better concepts, I think, than you having a series of guys who may have that very similar experience. You were talking that when it came to the Marine Corps and the Army. You said unification makes no sense because here are the historical examples of helicopter operations. Had there been one organization, either A, it wouldn't have been taken up as a concept, and then B, it wouldn't have been later developed as the other organization said, I find value in this, but I'm going to use it in a different way. So I think, are you saying,
that's
better framing?
Part of my argument is, in general, I just think unification on the, you know, taken on the altar of efficiency results in a lot worse third order effects than you originally see it. So I am willing to accept some of the inefficiencies in order to grow the diversity of responses and kind of the unique ways that those different services will attack things. You know, I think all the recent talk about, hey, get rid of the Air Force, we've seen Farley and some other guys talk about it. I think it's bunk. I think everybody brings something to the table. The Navy, the Marine Corps.
I do too. But see, I simply want it to be down one acquisition chain and one chain of command.
Yes.
I want the Marines to continue to do the things Marines do. I want Marines to understand sea control better. I want surface warfare officers to do what they've always done. I want them to understand the importance of fire support better. I'm not just suggesting you take these two services, lump them in under a thing, and then there you've got your organizational change. This would be a very, very comprehensive process that ultimately results in a 3-star who isn't interchangeable. He or she would certainly have a set of skills that they are best at, but they sure as hell would be better than the joint task force commanders are that we put out there today.
Maybe then, before we move on to some of the larger strategic stuff with the application of maritime security, for one last point for Chris, speak to the mechanism by which this would be done then. And perhaps that'll speak allay or maybe further.
No, I don't think I could allay. It would be wrenching. I mean, it would be as big as the National Security Act of 1947, if not bigger.
I probably can't get on board with you on this one, sir. But everything else you write about, I am 100%. I think every other piece that you called out in your national interest piece is, you know, so far in the black in terms of where we need to be. I can't dig on Starfleet uniforms and everybody being the wonderful unified super efficient command structure, because I think precedent and culture and the need for flexibility, which does not spring from those organizations that operate that way against it.
Okay.
But to get into the points that I think we are fully eating the same lunch on, I want to go back, and if I may, Matt, I want to ask him about.
Go ahead.
He speaks to, you know, our need to define the need for a strong Navy that's able to, you know, maritime force that's able to control the seas, that can not just kind of pay lip service to the A2AD threat, but actively counter that. And so I'm sure he's been following the debate that's been going on among maritime circles, amongst the kind of ASB offshore control. And then I just saw Information Dissemination had a piece that I think you brought up, Mr. McGrath, that spoke to kind of a mix, or rather disruption type strategy that may kind of split the difference between both of them. How do you see a new strategy? Where does it lay in between those different kind of polarities of where the current debate about how to design a force, how to shape a force in terms of what it would actually do in a conflict with China, or any near peer competitor, which right now you're not going to see too many other besides China.
The plain ugly truth is that if you create a force structure that is op and blockade, it cannot do air-sea battle.
Okay.
If you create a force that can do air-sea battle, it can do distant blockade. Okay. There is a quality of reversibility that that's very important to me in how we go forward. And one of the things that I've been most wary of the offshore control distant blockade crowd is that the first thing is I think it scares the hell out of our allies and friends. But more importantly, if you then do what we all want to do, which is to have strategy impact force structure, that strategy would drive a force structure in which we would be effectively ejected from East Asia because we couldn't survive. We couldn't fight there. That's just unacceptable to me. If we create a force structure and an architecture that allows us to create pockets of sea control from which we can project power. We don't have to stay there forever. We don't have to be able to withstand the full might of the Chinese strategic rocket force. But we have to be able to create those seams. And an offshore balancing Navy would never give us that. I think the important thing to recognize is that in this article that I wrote about, I strongly recommend that there be a classified annex to this strategy. We didn't have one in the last strategy. I briefed a lot of the defense attachés in Washington, and they would kind of nudge me and go, come on, you got a classified. I was like, no, we don't. In this case, because I believe the threat has clarified, because we're more aware and a better aware of what the stakes are, I think we ought to have a classified version, and that this question that you asked, Chris, would be answered very, very strongly in that section.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And just for everyone listening, we will have TX Hams and some other guests on the Monday, 24th of February podcast to talk about ASB and air-sea battle. And, sir, don't worry, air-sea battle will be handily represented by Tim Walton. So it will not.
Oh my goodness!
It will not be. It will not be without its very strong defenders.
My mentor.
I'm sure we'll be happy to hear that. Now we're talking. You mentioned our allies, so let's shift looks. Perhaps you mentioned the three hub strategy. Describe what the three hub strategy is, why it's important, and then maybe we can flesh out some of your concerns in the AEI piece about NATO at sea.
Yeah, we've largely abandoned the Mediterranean as a place to station credible combat power. Our two hub strategy in the 2007 strategy was one hub in the Western Pacific and one in the Indian Ocean / Arabian Gulf. The Mediterranean has asserted itself, right, throughout North Africa, in the Levant. There's been a great deal of things that have happened The president of the United States needs options, and I believe the lack of naval presence in the Mediterranean has led to him having fewer options than I would like our president to have. So I want a three-hub navy. I would like us – that should be part of the strategy. Even if the present force structure does not adequately support it, we need to get it on the record that this is what we believe is right for the country. Stretch goals, right? Put it out there and say a handful of destroyers on BMD missions in the Eastern Mediterranean is important, but it's not persuasive. It's not an aircraft carrier battle group. It's not a big deck amphib and 2,400 Marines, lurking over the horizon. That's not what three destroyers are. I think that third hub is essential. And quite frankly, it's kind of what we did post World War II anyway.
Now, would you say when you're talking about these hub strategy, one of your articles fleshed out part of that engagement, American strategy and offshore balancing by default at War on the Rocks. Perhaps maybe you could speak to your thoughts on the AFRICOM model. So you said, what's engagements? What are alliances? Well, you have to be on the ground. You have to do things. And there's been a lot of talk about the AFRICOM model, which is a lot of very quiet but very strong engagement with country security infrastructure and their chains of command. Do you think that AFRICOM is setting the tone and a model for the rest of what we do when it comes to training and engagement? Or maybe you have a different concept of a more conventional or out-of-the-box way that we should approach it.
I rarely think out of the box. But I do like to think. Listen, I don't know that much about AFRICOM. I'm sure you know Chris Rawley. He's probably a great guy to talk to on what AFRICOM does.
Oh, absolutely.
When I think about that article that you mentioned was not exactly the most positive article about offshore balancing. It was basically I don't like offshore balancing because as a grand strategy, it presumes a level of discernment in leaders that they rarely show. Right? You don't have lots of forces forward. You don't have under offshore balancing rubric, and you intervene only when it looks as though the existing security balance is going to change. Well, in my view, that means it's always late and expensive in terms of treasure and blood.
Exactly.
Which then presents you with this conundrum of, do we go and do it and spend all that treasure and blood, or do we just go and ask too hard? We're not going to do it. It's much easier to manage regional security balances if you are there already.
Exactly.
And you are managing the situation on a day-to-day basis. The problem with the AFRICOM model is, quite frankly, I don't have a good idea of threats that would develop there that are sufficiently large as to become American national security interests. Now, there are some interesting, the security of the oil fields off of Nigeria and the like are interesting, but I just haven't seen enough there for me to believe that we should spend a lot of time thinking about anything other than regular sort of special forces, Green Berets, the kind of people who are very skilled in that country or civil affairs, that sort of thing. I'm a conventional guy. When I argue for the Navy strategy, it's almost always going to be more of a conventional approach.
So then that was kind of like the logic line I was trying to drive this along is the AFRICOM takes that very, hey, we're here already engagement strategy. What do you see then as What is the delta? What's the change between, say, what we have in the Pacific right now? So we have bases in Japan. We have constant engagement. What is the change between what we have now and what you would like to see that would improve that condition that you're looking for?
Another carrier, another big deck amphib and its escorts, 2,000 Marines, 10 SSNs, 10 DDGs. If you look at the 2020 force on an average daily basis versus the 2013 force on an average daily basis in the Western Pacific, the difference, I think, is 9 ships, right? 4 of them will be LCSs, 3 of them will be amphibs, and a couple of JHSVs. There aren't any additional DDGs in that theater. There aren't any additional SSNs in that theater. I want combat power, credible combat power. In my view, the fastest way to have a war with China is to make China think they can win. And I want that EC fleet commander to wake up every morning and look out his window and say, today is not the day. And that's conventional deterrence. And the key to conventional deterrence is preponderance of local forces. And I don't see us – we don't have it. We're making some interesting moves, and there are things that we're doing that I'm very supportive of. But in general, we need to do more.
Perfect. And in that regard, looking at the lack of that preponderance of force, what you're looking for, while the United States is trying to wrestle with this challenge and try to rebalance our forces around the world, you came out with that AEI piece – talking about NATO fleets and how they've become essentially miniaturized versions of themselves. I think you said, with the exception of the Germans, no one's looking to specialize.
Right.
How has that affected your thinking? What concerns you? Is there a way out, or is this just a strategic reality we're going to have
it's
to deal with?
It's a strategic reality that I'm very concerned about. I mean, it just boggles my mind that the Royal Navy will consist of 19 ships, 19 surface ships. It boggles my mind. Why is it? Well, it's because they're going to build 2 aircraft carriers, because they're going to build 3 SSBNs. They want all the trappings of a full fleet architecture. Yet what it does is it makes them less capable of seeing to their broadly dispersed interests. And quite frankly, in my view, it makes them less valuable to us as a naval partner. You know, we need friends in numbers, especially as our own numbers begin to decline. And I think they will decline. I think we are on a path to a 240 ship Navy by 2030. And our major allies are on the same path. A Navy that looks like what they have now, just smaller. I would like to see, you know, more navies like Germany, which seems to be specializing in escorts. And they've got a joint command ship, an amphibious sort of a humanitarian support ship that they're looking at. My problem is with nations that I believe are looking at their sea power as a manhood issue, rather than an outward manifestation of a coherent strategy.
So, Matt, I got 2 questions regarding that. First part, as it relates to it, I see the logic behind the 3-hub Navy and the need to take the Pacific, but in light of the challenges we are facing fiscally and maybe acquisitions wise to get the ships we need for, you know, to make that East China Sea fleet commander scared, why don't we incentivize those European countries to stop going the manhood route, start going the right route to control their backyard, i.e. The Mediterranean, while keeping what you said, and I think it was, you know, completely apropos of we need to be able to give options, but maybe do we need to cede some of those options to the individuals that have more skin in the game so we can focus on the more dangerous threat? Certainly national security interests there, but maybe something that is more easily to take our eye off the ball of that East China Sea
I mean, that's certainly that would certainly be helpful in the short term. I don't see those countries. I don't see them turning it around. I really don't.
Yeah.
I don't see them turning it around. You know, we had the big deck job in Libya was primarily NATO. To the extent that there were big decks there, they ran out of PGMs. It was a good effort against an absolutely feckless opponent. And if you begin to move up the capability scale, I don't want to subcontract out our interests to them.
Just for everybody's reference, PGM, precision guided munition. Okay, so everybody.
They also ran out of fuel and ISR and runways.
Yeah.
they ran out about everything except a plane and a pilot that's needed to conduct those operations.
And,
but
and we ran out of Gaddafis too. So.
Second question, sir. So as you see it, there's been another debate that's gone on when Secretary Hagel came out with his basic proposition that listen, we can either pay for readiness or pay for modernization. We can't have both. And as that pertains to the Navy and the fleet that you're envisioning in Supreme Commander President McGrath's world, what is the laydown between those two things as it pertains to this Navy, and what do we need to have? Specifically, if you could speak to the criticisms against the LCS versus maybe more capable platforms or more proven platforms vis-a-vis Aegis class stuff or maybe new stuff down the pipe, more Zumwalt, something like that. How do you see that playing out? How do you see that? Where do you see that needing to go?
I come at this from the perspective of a guy who has consistently argued for years that the Navy is too small. I don't care what physical condition we are in. The United States Navy, you know, we're in this. Everybody says, well, we're in a post-war downturn, and it's characteristic to expect a 30% drop in force levels. The Navy didn't build up for this war. All right, so we are down 19% since the war started. It's almost 20% now since the war started. We've been declining as we fought the war, and now there's a sense of, well, we should get smaller. So with all due respect to Secretary Hagel, he's out of his mind. I don't think the trade should be between readiness and modernization. I think the trade should be between American sea power and America's garrison forces. That's where I see this argument should go. We should make strategic choices about how we are going to tend our knitting during what I believe is an uncharacteristically peaceful period. This is not a spectacularly bellicose time in our history. We are supposed to be out of Afghanistan this year. I don't know whether that'll happen completely. We don't have existential threats to the country. Let American sea power tend to our knitting while America's garrison forces concentrate on modernizing. Okay, they should be concentrating on modernizing. They should get smaller and better. And they should create the architectures that can then get filled out as time goes on. I believe we have time, and we have the opportunity to take strategic risk. Why do we have that? Because we have a Navy and a Marine Corps. And so that force, obviously, you can't just make it ready, only ready. It has to be modernized also. But that would come the price would be paid by the readiness of the Army and the Air Force. That's how I would handle that.
And as pertains to the modernization, what's the future do you see?
You asked me specifically about LCS. I don't know. I should do a Google search on this because I don't know that I've ever come out either as an LCS guy or not an LCS guy. The LCS reminds me a lot of the F-16. I remember when the F-16 was being talked about, there were a lot of people who thought it's not capable. And we've built a bazillion F-16s, and F-16s have done amazing things for this military. Let's face it, the vast majority of the time in a Navy ship's life, it is not spent fighting and shooting. It's spent carrying around a flag that hangs from the yardarm. And LCSs do that just fine. And if we can build them in numbers and employ them in numbers and employ them with employment schemes that get more ASABO, operational availability out of them per hull than we get currently, I think that's a pretty darn good thing. I've seen some of the reports about specifically the ASW module. These are classified reports, but what I can tell you, and Admiral Roden talked about it at Surface Navy Association at an unclassified level, but the bottom line is there's a lot of capability in that ASW module. Capability that would allow, we like to do ASW with two ships. You don't have to do two DDGs doing a SAG. You get one DDG can go off and do DDG things while the other one operates with the LCS. As a legitimate wartime ASW platform. I've got no beef with LCS, especially since we, cut the DDX down to three DDG 1000s and we got rid of the CGX altogether, which were the other two ships that were named with the LCS in November of 2001 as this SC-21 family of ships. Well, the family has gotten a lot smaller.
Well, what are your thoughts with the new Deputy Undersecretary Christine Fox? They've now started talking about the next frigate, so bringing a new frigate into the fleet. Do you have any thoughts on that? I know it's a rather recent announcement, but maybe I'm sure you've thought about this in the past. Do you have any reflections on that since we're talking about the modernization and sort of where the fleet will go in the future?
Well, I had a CO that used to tell me, you want it bad, you get it bad. And if we decide that we all of a sudden want to now create a frigate out of pixie dust, we could be recreating on a monumental scale some of the problems with the accelerated acquisition of LCS. That doesn't mean we can't do it, and it doesn't mean we can't do it well. It means we have to do it carefully and with malice aforethought. Quite frankly, I would like to see there be a ship in the 5,000 or 6,000 ton size that can keep up with the aircraft carrier, that can do open ocean ASW, that can do some area air defense, sort of the a traditional escort mission for $1 billion a copy or less. That's the sweet spot, right? The Flight 3 DDGs are not going to be that ship. Those are going to be incredibly capable, high-end warships, the most sophisticated warship I know of. We can't build those in numbers. We need to build capable combat ships in numbers in that mid 5,000, 6,000 ton range.
Yeah, and there's a lot of folks now talking about that flotilla concept and what do we bring for the high-low. We talk all the time about high. We don't talk often about low. But now talking about things we need in the future, places we should go. You mentioned before the podcast places we should not go, and you wanted to talk about the SSBNX and your thoughts about it. To close out the show, throw this firebomb into the audience and see what happens.
I think we really need to be very, very careful about what the SSBNX costs. And I don't just mean dollars. I mean what it will do to the shipbuilding budget if dollars don't come from somewhere to buy those hulls. We would be, in my view, devastating our conventional deterrent in order to fund this strategic deterrent. And it's a strategic deterrent that, in my view, becomes increasingly less worthwhile as time goes on. I'm not against – I truly believe the United States needs a strategic deterrent. I believe we need the ability to reach out and touch someone with nuclear weapons. I just believe that what we get for the SSBNX, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. The extra level of deterrence that it brings us is not worth $150 to $200 billion in life cycle costs over the lifetime of that ship. That's the Royal Navy right there. You are passing up a navy that the size of the Royal Navy in terms of acquisition and life cycle costs in order to carry out this third way of deterring strategic nuclear strikes on us. And I don't think it's worth it. I think it really bears closer scrutiny, and it's something that I'm working very hard on these days.
Would you say a replacement, a new version of an alternative version of the SSBNX, or would you just concentrate and say, hey, the SSBNs that we have now, they're capable, they do their job, let's concentrate on maintaining, you know, their life and modernization?
I believe strongly that the survivable leg of the deterrent isn't worth the money we spend on it. So whether it's done some other way or not, still means we'd have to spend money to do it. I am a minority of one that I know of on this. I almost no one agrees with me on this one, and it's probably a reflection of the quality of my argument. But at the end of the day, we have other ways of deterring somebody from conducting nuclear attacks on us. We have ICBMs and we have bombers. And I know the Air Force has its challenges, but those are leadership challenges, right? I mean, those are leadership challenges. Yeah. That's not a strategy challenge. I think we can. I believe the U.S. Navy uniquely, the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Marine Corps together as American sea power uniquely tend to the conventional deterrence problem around the world. And recapitalizing the SSBNX, the SSBN force, will invariably make it tougher to do that, which creates the almost Orwellian situation of, if you build the SSBNX, you hamstring your conventional deterrent. You hamstring your conventional deterrent, a conventional war with another major power is more likely to happen. Nuclear war with a major power is most likely to happen as a result of a conventional war. Therefore, under my theory, if you build the SSBNX, you make the very war that it was built to deter more likely to happen. And that is something we ought to think about.
That's definitely food. That is food for thought. Chris, do you have any final thoughts, questions to throw Brian's way?
No. I think we had a very good interchange, bit of intellectual sparring going on, and I really do want to reiterate the point that I think Mr. McGrath is doing some very interesting thinking out there, and presenting some pretty good contra viewpoints in a field that typically gets dominated by a few voices. So I have nothing else to add.
For the young J.O. Swo that I am, was very educational to watch you two guys go at it. As a final thought, Brian, we often ask people what they think the next threat, the next problem is going to be. We talked about all of those things today, so I would ask you then, what do you see? Who is our best friend going to be in the coming decades? Because we already talked about the problems with NATO. And what do you see as the shining light? What do you see as the – we've talked about the problems with the way the fleet is going and procurement. What do you see as our greatest hope to hang our – well, you can't hang your hat on a hope, but one that we might be able to follow?
In terms of friends, it's hard – it is – it's hard to look past the UK. And so it's such a cliche to say the UK that I'll avoid it and I'll say Canada.
Good hedge.
Well, Canada is, you know, I think we did $1 trillion worth of trade with Canada last year. Canada was able to weather the financial crisis better than we did, because I think they have some interesting elements in their banking system. Canada has a good bite-sized military that comes out and plays. I think Canada is somebody that we will continue to have a great friendship with, and someone that we can learn from. And that's something that I would like us to do. Maybe that's our shining light. Our shining light is that we, unlike any other country of which I am aware, are able to reinvent ourselves. You guys are both a little younger than I am, so you don't remember what the United States was like in the 1975.
I've watched The Warriors. It was a pretty good documentary.
Yeah, I saw The Warriors, and I mean, we've all seen Dirty Harry, so, and you know, RoboCop, if you're going to talk about the 80s.
The mid 70s really, really sucked. I mean, it was bad. We got kicked out of Vietnam. We had a president who resigned in disgrace. When in an oil crisis in 73 or 74, you could only buy gas on every other day. If your license plate ended in an odd number, you could go on odd days, even numbers on even days. It was just a whole bucket of suck. And then we elected Jimmy Carter as president, which just brought it all. It just
kicked the man while he's down.
Japan was kicking our ass. Japan was kicking our ass by every measure. The Soviet Union looked 20 feet tall. And then we won a hockey game. No, I mean, I'm serious about this. We won a hockey game. We elected a guy who told us, hey, we're better than this, right? And we were. And we figured it out. And we got our act together. And we created knuckleheads like you sometimes in the 1980s. But you're the beneficiaries of a country that said, hey, no more. No more. I think we retain the ability to do that. I pray that we retain the ability to do that. And I think that's our bright shining light, is that we know how to do that.
I hope you know I'm adding... Usually there's just music at the beginning of the show. There is going to be music during that speech, just for reference.
You need to put Wolverines right at the end of it.
Just so yell it out.
Straight,
Warriors, yep. Come out to play.
Well, no, I was thinking more Red Dawn, Wolverines, when they cry it out. So that would be even. I'm all about it. I'm ready to go stomp some commies in the throat right now.
I just we it's all still there. It's all still there. It's just sleeping. It's just sleeping.
Well, there we go. That's the note to go out on. Brian, you have opened up your own independent consultancy group called the Ferry Bridge Group. I think that's the website. Yep. www.ferrybridge.com.
Ferrybridgegroup.com.
Ferrybridgegroup.com.
Yep.
Is there anything else? Do you have Conservative Wahoo? Is your website?
I write a political blog called The Conservative Wahoo. You can just Google that and it'll bring you to it.
Google that, yeah. And it's so much easier. You try to remember the website names and you're like, yeah, Google exists for a reason. It's the title. You write for War on the Rocks. You've written for Proceedings. You've written for The National Interest. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug? Any projects that you're working on that you'd like people to know?
I want
to
plug SimSec for the good work that you guys are doing. And you guys are mastering a number of different media, and I think that's great. Keep it up.
Appreciate it. And if you are interested in said SimSec and you don't know about us, A, I'd like to know how you found this podcast. B, if you'd like to find us on the web, it is www.simsec.org, C-I-M-S-E-C, and that is the same for our Twitter handle, at SimSec. Chris, have you got anything that you're working on you want to plug? No?
No, just SimSec. Biden's keep reading, keep joining, and keep being part of the discussion.
Absolutely, and you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Please rate, give us 5 stars, and leave a comment. Let us know how you're doing. And if you don't think we're doing well, give us a 5-star rating, and then leave a comment, and I promise that we will correct ourselves immediately. Brian, it's been educational. It's been a pleasure. This is a lot of fun. This is one of my favorite podcasts so far. Really, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you both.